For the last 5 years, core homelessness has been rising year on year in England.
I think if you're someone who doesn't own their own home, who has a mortgage, who maybe has a car on finance, things like this,
Yeah. Know
you are 3 paychecks away from being homeless.
Why is this and how can we address it? It is interesting how developed this country is, how rich this country is, and the kind of homelessness level. Billy Chip is an alternative currency for the homeless, which allows the public to directly donate to Rough Sleepers without fear of their donations being misused for drugs or alcohol. In this episode, I sit down with Jack Gascoigne, Communications Director at Billy Chip, to find out more about their journey and to delve into the homelessness epidemic.
I want more than just a peace. Wanna be heard from the west to the east. I worked in my craft and I prayed for my time on the scene. The man have never left my team. 19, learned the right creed. Nah, I'm not a right breed, but I might be. In my crease, Nikes hit up my G. I'll still never sell out my theme. Well, you know about heritage, you go inherited. Don't chill with the snakes, but the flow still venomous. Perspective is everything. So much lemonade, I don't know what a lemon is.
Jack, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
You know, we just want VT about what you do. But I think it's always really good, actually, when guests also give a have a chance to say who they are in their own words. So how do you think about yourself and the work that you do?
I suppose I just quite simply describe myself as Jack from Bristol, really. I'm 24. I'm quite new to the whole, I suppose, the charity industry. I've only been working in it for the last sort of 18 months, 2 years. And it's all sort of very fresh to me. So I sort of suppose I'll describe myself as still learning. I really enjoy what I do. I find it really, really interesting. And I find, certain crossovers with things like that I'm sort of personally interested in for a lot into what I do with the charity and with Billy Chip. And it's sort of one of those things where if you told me 4 or 5 years ago, this is what I'd be doing, I'd laugh. But, you know, now we're here, it all seems to sort of make sense and stuff. So, yeah, I suppose that's me. I'm Jack from Bristol, really.
Okay, I mean, it's fascinating because we were talking, off air about this, the fact that you're from the Chew Valley.
Yeah.
Now, I'm from Southeast London. I have no clue what's in front, above Tottenham. Well, yeah. I used to have changed now, but when I was younger, I didn't know what that was. So what is, for those who are kind of listening, what is the Chew Valley? Like, what's happening there?
The Chew Valley is a part of land between Bristol and Bath, and it's mainly made up of two lakes. So you've got Chew Valley Lake and you've got Blagdon Lake, and both of those lakes provide water for Bristol. So it's a very nice part of the country. It is a valley, hence the name Chew Valley. And there's really nice sort of little villages there. There's not a lot going on, but certainly I'd sort of rather be living there during like lockdowns, for example, than in Southeast London, because there's a lot more sort of greenery and nice walks you can go on. But I find myself coming up the M4 corridor a lot to do things, because it's sort of, I suppose, where it's happening a bit more than sort of our leafy farmer fields.
So what do you remember the most about growing up? I would love to, because in my head, the whole point of common sense is bringing people with different perspectives together, different lived experiences. I think our lived experiences are probably like opposite, right? Because I grew up in like a concrete jungle, it felt sometimes. And I'm just wondering now, what are your fondest memories of growing up where you grew up?
When I was first born, I lived in the middle of Bristol. So I lived in a place called Bedminster, on a road that backed onto Bristol City's ground. So it's called Luckwell Road. People from Bristol will know it. And then I moved out to another place. Shout out Luckwell Road. And then I moved to another place called Dundry, which was in between the Chew Valley and Bedminster. It's on like a really high hill, so we had like quite a nice view of the city and stuff, but you're sort of on the fringes there of the countryside and the city. I then went to Chew Valley School, which is a secondary school, so I started there when I was 11, and that was really my sort of first introduction of like spending proper sort of quality time in the countryside. I mean, although I was in a you know, probably the biggest school in the area, a comprehensive school with, I think, 1,100 students. It was plonked in the middle of nowhere. So, you know, as soon as you're outside of that environment, you really have to sort of entertain yourself, really. But, you know, it was amazing time to grow up. And the school that I went to had a real sort of mixture of people in it. So it had people who were sort of from the city, who perhaps maybe less like affluent than my friends who lived in sort of big man houses in the villages out in the countryside. So it sort of allowed me to have a really sort of good perspective of the community around me, I suppose, because I wasn't just sort of zoned into one box. I wasn't that person who sort of had, you know, one group of friends. I like to sort of mingle around and sort of talk to people. And I was always sort of interested in what people were doing and how they felt about certain things. And I suppose that's sort of, you know, one of the reasons why I sort of become friends with Billy, because, you know, we were never sort of, you know, we weren't labeled as like, you know, the kids who played sports or, you know, the kids who went on the computers. We were just sort of, we would just float about and do our own thing. And I suppose we must have sort of found a bit of a common ground with that and, you know, become friends off of it with, you know, other mates of mine. But yeah, it's a really, it's a really lovely place to go. And like I said, you know, during the lockdowns, I was living at my girlfriend's. And yeah, just, you know, being able to go out the door and just sort of walk straight into fields and stuff was just really nice. I mean, my brother lives in Hackney and, you know, he couldn't leave his flat for months and months with two twins. Like, I think they were 9 at the time. So yeah, certainly no, it wasn't envious of his situation at all. So yeah, it has its good and bad points living there. But I'd say on the whole, mainly good, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I now that I'm much older, you know, much older, a bit older. Do you go out into the countryside? You know, I was in Wales not too long ago. And it is so interesting how, you know, I just imagine that your experience of the UK must be so coloured by where you live and where you're from. Because for me, London's always, sorry, the UK, when I think about the UK, I think about London, right? And I think about busy, you know, council flats, running around, playing sports, just kind of, just you know, even when I was young, I think I had like a full schedule, just like different things going on all the time. And so I didn't make as much time than I probably should have for like reading or for walking. I mean, walking is... For me, I remember when I first discovered walking was a thing. Because for me, like you walk to where you're going.
Yeah.
Right? So when someone's like, I'm going walking, I remember kind of thinking, I think I overheard someone saying that. I was thinking, well, where are you going? And they're like, no, we're going for a walk. And I thought, but you need to be going somewhere.
Yeah.
In some parts of the country where it's actually nice to walk, people walk.
Yeah.
When I was growing up, I would have walked past a local Lidl, local Tesco, like, you know, there was really nothing to see like that. So that's so fascinating. Now, you've mentioned Billy there, and for some people listening and watching, they might be like, who's that? What's going on? So do you want to tell us a bit about, you know, who Billy was and how almost he was the impetus for the stuff you're doing now?
Yeah. So Billy Abernathy Hope was one of my sort of best friends growing up. So we're quite a close-knit friend group, and so from the age of sort of, I'd say sort of 12 to the age of 20, me, Bill, and sort of 4 or 5 others, I suppose, did a lot of stuff together. You know, we go to like festivals when we were just sort of like branching out and, you know, going to like music gigs and stuff like that. I'd always go with Bill when he was one of those people who was just up for anything. You know, you made a bit bored, you had a motive, you know, do you want to come to this gig? Do you want to come to this bar? Whatever. He'd always be like, yeah. You know, I'll come out. So he was the sort of, I suppose he was like the life of our friendship group. He was always that one, you know, to make jokes and be the loudest person in the room. And so sadly, Billy passed away in 2018. So he was an ambulance driver for a couple of years. And he decided sort of, you know, in the sort of latter parts of the year that he wanted to go off traveling and he wanted to see the world. So he went out to Thailand in the March of 2018 with another friend of mine, Elliot, and 5 days in, sadly, come off a motorbike, and that was it. He hit the sort of soft part on the back of his head. That was how Billy went. And because of the sort of reasons and the I suppose a sort of red tape around people dying abroad, we were never able to have a proper funeral for Billy. So he was cremated abroad, you know, those ashes sort of sent back. So it was a really sort of strange time. And also, I think that time in your life as well, you know, when I was 19, you know, that's when you're just sort of getting into adulthood. It's when you're just sort of deciding of like what you want to do. So it was a lot of a lot of things, I suppose, sort of put on me very, very quickly. You know, I was moving out of like my sort of family home at the time, moving into moving in with my partner, and yeah, it was just it was just something that I couldn't ever, you know, think of. Like I said, Billy was one of those people who was just so alive all the time, and to, you know, to have to wake up that morning and, you know, get see the text on my phone of what happened, it was just couldn't believe it. And yeah, like, you know, for that person who was just so alive all the time to then, you know, pass and just, you know, that's it, he's gone. Yeah, it was a real, it was hard to take. And you know, I think even still now, I think even sort of what we're doing with a charity that I'll get onto a bit in a minute, yeah, there's still sort of those days where I just, you know, I just think he's still on holiday, I just think he's still away. But he's not, you know, he is gone, he has sort of gone on and moved on, and that's something that me and my friends have had to suppose deal with in our own little ways.
Yeah, it's, I mean, it must be really difficult, doubly, because, you know, I guess, you know, how would you say you've dealt with the closure? Because that's something that, you know, you often need when someone passes, is the closure of, you know, seeing them, you know, a funeral or cremation, whatever it is. Do you feel like you've had that closure? Or
yeah, so we had so over a year after Billy died, we had a festival in his parents' garden. So we had people can find it on YouTube if they want. It's called Festival, Festabil it was called, and we had 1,200 people turn up. Ticketed it. The money from that launched his charity, Billy Chip. We had Professor Green turn up and play in his garden, and it was amazing. And I think for me, that was, you know, I look back on it now, and I think that was the sort of turning point in my life. I wasn't sort of, you know, mentally well before that. I was sort of, you know, coming to terms with a lot more other things than just sort of losing Billy. That sort of, I suppose, that sort of coming of age of being an adult. It was just something, when I was a kid, I just couldn't see myself being in my mid-20s having a job. It just seemed so alien to me at the time. And I think, yeah, like looking back on it, I think that day was the sort of turning point. I think that there was a few things that happened that day that were very personal to Billy, and there was wishes that he wanted, and we managed to sort of fulfill all of those things. So for me, I think that that was the moment I sort of had closure, and I sort of said, right, you know, we've done this now, you know, let's move on, let's try and do what we can as a legacy for Bill, but ultimately we've got to sort of go on and live our lives, because he wouldn't want us to be miserable. You know, I know it sounds clichéic, but he really wouldn't want to be. I think he'd feel, you know, really guilty if he sort of if he knew of the sort of impact that his death had had on people. And I think that onus and that responsibility then falls on you to sort of, you know, make the most out of your life, because you know, people aren't around anymore.
And I think one of the most beautiful things that can happen is when a tragic, really sad situation can turn into something that can do good or can be that. So you took, you know, you took, you know, that sad experience, and then you used his name to set up a foundation, or you kind of set up a foundation in his name. Like, how did that work?
Yeah, so our charity is called Billy Chip, and it is we operate a safe and secure currency for the public to donate directly to homeless people should they feel hesitant to handing over cash. That's our sort of tagline. But that idea was originally Billy's idea. So, you know, I think 2 or 3 weeks before we went traveling, he was having a conversation with his dad, John. Who John used to be a sales director, you know, he used to earn sort of good money, like me, never thought he'd be running a charity in his wildest dreams. And he come home one day, like a lot of us do, with, you know, a couple of quid in his pocket, and he had a big pot of change, one of those, I think, you know, everyone's seen them, those big sort of Coca-Cola bottles, you know, you have when you're sort of 13, 14 as a money pot, and, you know, he chuck his change in there. And Billy was always, you know, very conscious and very sort of outspoken about if he thought people weren't, you know, doing their part in society, you know, if they weren't helping. I think the role he had as an ambulance driver really sort of cemented that.
Yeah, yeah. Service.
Yeah, because he was looking after people who, you know, couldn't get to, you know, chemo appointments, you know, by themselves. And those sort of things, I think people, you know, with a support network don't, you know, take for granted, you know, just being able to get somewhere. You know, I got lifted to the train station this morning, you know, and it was just something I didn't think of. I just asked my friend, go and do it. But, you know, if you haven't got that support network around you, doing the most basic things in life is really hard. And that's what Billy's role was. It was taking people to and from hospital appointments, you know, making sure they were well. So he always had this very sort of conscious, you know, thought process of how other people were looking after themselves.
Yeah.
And John come home one day and chucked some change in the pot, and Billy asked him what he was going to do with it. I mean, whether that was because, you know, Billy wanted it, or whether it was, you know, he was genuinely, I think Billy just wanted to sort of talk and say, you know, what, and he said, what are you going to do with that money, Dad? And he said, oh, I don't know, you know, I might save it up, buy a bottle of whiskey for Christmas, I might donate it to charity. He said, you know, don't know why. And Bill said, you know, you make me laugh. He said, you got a pot there of sort of 70, 80 quid. You know, you don't really know how much is in there. You don't need it. Your plan is to give it to charity, but yet you would step over someone who's cold and hungry in the street. You know, and John is quite admitting that he would. And he turned around to Billy and said, yeah, he said, as much as it's a nice idea of, you know, and that sort of primary thing of being able to help someone who hasn't got anything, what I don't want to do is give someone a load of cash and then wake up and watch the news and see that something that I've tried to do as a positive on their life has become a detriment. And that's a thought, that's a thought process that a lot of people in our country have. And John was brought up with, you know, public information adverts, you know, telling you don't give cash to homeless people.
Yeah.
Teachers even telling them in school. I have a vague memory of police officers telling me in primary school, secondary school, but I can't quite remember, but it was certainly there. And so, you know, John said, well, as much as that's a nice idea, I don't want it to cause harm to someone. And yeah. Billy turned around and said, well, why isn't there a token that you can buy for homeless people that can only be redeemed for certain things in like KFC, McDonald's, Greggs, places like that? Because then the person donating the money would know where the money went to. And, you know, drug dealers won't want to take a token. That's not how their business works. And it was really to solve a problem and that sort of prejudice against what homeless people are going to use money for.
Yeah.
You know, even on this journey now, like a few years later, we would never tell anyone not to give homeless people money. I still give homeless people money. But the point of the Billy chip is that it's there for as a resource for people who do have those hesitancies and think, you know, oh, I'm not going to give you cash on it. And a lot of people nowadays are also very hesitant of donating to big charities because, yeah. You know, we see it in the news all the time, you know, CEOs earning £250,000 a year, £500,000 a year. And, you know, ultimately all of their money is coming from public donations. So there's really, you know, there was a gap there, I think. And I think Billy noticed that. And I think often the best ideas are the most simple. And I think that also the best ideas are normally the ideas that solve problems. And what I like about it as well is, you know, you almost hit that wall, don't you, of, you know, do you donate to homeless people? Well, no. Or do you donate cash to homeless people? Well, no, because I don't want them to go and spend it on drugs.
Yeah.
Well, do you donate to charity? No, because I don't know where my donation goes. And that was where the conversation stopped. And, you know, that's a lot of people in this country that feel like that. And so, you know, we've sort of come along with the Billy chip to try and, you know, offer a solution because, you know, without people trying to look at this problem in a different way and a progressive way, I don't think the situation is going to change. You know, there's thousands and thousands of charities across the UK doing incredible work trying to end homelessness. There doesn't seem to be many people just trying to make it a bit easier to be homelessness because everyone's concern is just let's end homelessness, let's do this. And we've sort of come at it from a different angle and saying, well, you know, that's great what you're doing. You try and end homelessness. You give it your best shot. We're going to try and make it a bit easier for them and hopefully raise some money for you guys to continue doing your work.
Yeah.
And that's where we've really come from it. So, you know, it's sort of a bit of a new idea, a bit of a sort of, I suppose, a break of the mold just to try and see, you know, whether this new approach could really sort of make a big impact.
I love it. I mean, I think, you know, we met at a network event with the QCT. And when you first said it, I remember being like, it's brilliant. Like it's such an obvious, maybe I'm just a super logical guy, right? But it just seems like a clear solution to people who are stuck in that stalemate of Oxfam's so big. How do I know that the guy on the floor gets the money, right? And then, you know, if I give money to homeless people, they're going to spend it on drugs. Like, you're right. People are just kind of stuck there.
Yeah.
And this is a clear solution, you know. And I want to come back to some of the things you said because there's so many different things to unpack there. But I guess before we do that, just on Billy Chip still, like, what's the reception been like? So you guys started it, you know, 4 or 5 years ago. You know, what's the reception been like? Has it been well received?
Yeah.
Talk a bit about that.
Yeah, so we started, we launched Billy Chip as a trial at the end of 2019. And so me, Billy's sister Megan, and Billy's auntie Claire went around with a little sort of shopping trolley with leaflets trying to sign up independent coffee shops to start a trial. And we got, I think, 10 or 12 on board to do a trial.
Super.
You know, got the Billy chips made, sent them all out. You know, when we started it, we were just trying to work out the sort of framework of how it would work. So one of the big players that came on board early doors was a takeaway chain called Boston Tea Party that are dotted around the Southwest. But they don't give out cups. So people who buy coffee from them have to have their own disposable cup or buy a
interesting.
Yeah. So obviously for homeless people, that's an issue. So we did have conversations about having like Billy chip flasks, and you know, at one point that was the road we were going down. We sort of, you know, from other conversations, we come away from that idea. So that sort of month, just sort of 3 month period, I think at the end of 2019, was really where we were going through our teething issues of how this is going to look. But we decided on the token idea. We worked out the way of how we can have it as a recyclable currency. So when someone pays with a Billy chip, it goes in the till and then can be sold on to someone else. So, you know, it's sort of the sort of framework of the business is quite unique. You know, no one buys a can of Coke and then goes back into the shop and tries to buy something else with that can of Coke. It's quite complex. But we set up in November 2019, and we were fortunate enough to have massive media coverage from it. I think largely from the story that sits behind it, with the sort of memory of Billy, and it being set up mainly by his family. I think it's quite it's a good news story, I think.
Absolutely.
You know, if I'm honest. And so we got picked up by local radio. It then went on to local TV. Then it went on to national TV. So it went on like BBC Breakfast, ITV. We were everywhere. We were the most viewed video on the BBC News Instagram for 2019. You know,
that's
bigger than
so
like David Attenborough. Yeah, it just, and you know, this is literally something that started with me, Megan, and Auntie Claire walking around with a granny shopping trolley with leaflets in it. And yeah, it just went mad. So we went, we were seeing 80% growth in outlets signing up month on month. And yeah, it got to March. We were so busy, John had to leave his job because we had so many places signed up in Bristol and Bath, and it was spreading as well. You know, it spread into Cheltenham, to Swindon, to Oxford, other places.
South East London?
Not well. You say that. We had someone sign up in Croydon this morning.
Oh, would you look at that?
Yeah. Cheers. So we are getting there. We're slowly and steadily getting there. But at that point, we hadn't set up anything. You know, we didn't have a foundation. We didn't have a community interest company. We literally just had an idea, and largely from the fact that we didn't really know what to do. You know, that there isn't like a sort of guidebook, I suppose, of how to create an alternative currency for homeless people.
it's so amazing. So how many stores would you say you have signed up now, like if you had to
So we've got about, I think it's about 110. Wow. Now, mainly in Bristol and Bath. We've got Greg's on board now in Bristol and
amazing.
Bath. So they have been running a trial from May, I think, and it's gone really well, so they've kept doing it. The plan is to roll it out to a lot more Greg stores early next year. But yeah, I mean, you know, going sort of back to the story of how it was launched, you know, we got to that March, John left his job, to focus full time on this and really sort of answer the call of all of these places wanting to do it. And it wasn't just places in the UK, it was places in, you know, Australia, America, South Africa. It just went everywhere because of the power of the BBC. And I kid you not, about 4 days after, you know, we made this jump, we went as lockdown.
Oh my
and,
days.
Yeah, and you know, high street shut, obviously, you know, that's how we operate. Thankfully, all homeless people were housed during the lockdown, so it is possible, you know, they can do it. But I suppose it was also a bit of a blessing because we didn't have the foundation set up, we didn't have the CIC set up, and if we wanted to do this properly, we needed that, you know, that legitimacy sat behind what we were doing. So we initially tried to set up Billy Chip as a charity, but the sort of back and forth from the Charity Commission, they come back and said that the average member of the public wasn't able to determine whether someone was really homeless or not, or whether they were in need or not. So we had to set up as a community interest company, which is like the new sort of wording for an NGO.
NGO social enterprise.
And then we also set up a foundation that distributes the money that we raise. So we have a Billy Chip, we have Billy Chip CIC, and we have the Billy Chip Foundation, and Billy Chip CIC is asset locked to the foundation, and any profits we raise go to the foundation to then fund other homeless and mental health services. Lockdown or that sort of, you know, time was really a blessing for us, because we had that opportunity to sort of take a step back. We also set up an app, which means that regardless of where people are based in the UK, they can sign up and operate the Billy Chip. It's what makes orders all augmented. So there's like a very sort of light background check we do on businesses to make sure you don't sell alcohol. You sign up, it takes you about 2 minutes, and then, you know, 2 days later, you have your starter pack in the post with your all your Billy Chips for free. And then at the end of the month, you submit your sales and redemptions on our app. That then creates an invoice. You pay us £2 for any chips that you sold, and then any redemptions you've given out, we then credit that invoice for £1.
That's actually good. That brings me on to what I want to do next. I want to ask a few questions. So about the Billy Chip. Why does that sound like I was speaking in a Jamaican accent? About the Billy Chip. So let's do that. So for some of the people who maybe are listening, they probably can't see it, they should head over to the YouTube. You don't have to, you don't have to become a watcher, you can be stay a listener. But you know, you bought us this, was a keychain. Is the Billy Chip this big, or is it smaller?
So that is a Billy Chip that's just had John's mate Kevin drill a hole through it and had a little keychain on.
Super. And so,
shout out Kevin Moon on the on the keyrings, what a guy.
Might mess up the focus, but there you go. So I can sign up and get, go on your website, I sign up and I get how many of these?
No, so you can only sign up if you're an outlet.
Okay, got you.
So for members of the public, the only way you can buy a Billy Chip is through your local outlet.
Got it.
And you buy it alongside your cup of coffee in the morning. We do have ways where people can buy Billy Chips online, but they don't get delivered to you. So, they get delivered to outreach services.
So how would I know that my local outlet is signed up to this kind of scheme or is part of this kind of program?
So if you scan that QR code, it takes you to a location finder that tells you the nearest place that Billy Chip can be redeemed. So it will show you all of the places in the UK that operate the Billy Chip, and also more sort of locally on a sort of street level, anywhere that operates Billy Chip has a Billy Chip sticker in their window. So not only do the public know they can buy Billy Chips from that outlet, homeless people also know that not only, you know, they can redeem Billy Chips in there, but they'll be welcomed. So, you know, they won't be sort of treated as a nuisance. They'll, you know, have the same experience everyone else will.
Got it. So literally, I mean, that, you're answering my questions like perfectly, because I think it leads on to the next thing is, so I go to an out, you know, I'm kind of curious about this after listening to this podcast, for instance, I go to my local shop, I see there's a sticker, I'm like super, I buy my cup of coffee, a mocha, you know, with oat milk. And then I say, but can I get, you know, can I get three Billy Chips as well? They gave me the three Billy Chips. When I see a local person who's homeless and I, you know, want to support, I can give them one of this. They then have to basically essentially walk around and see if there's a sticker to see if they can redeem it there, essentially.
Yeah. So what we hope, I mean, you know, no one's really dishing out Billy Chips and saying to someone, you know, walk 2 miles down the road. Normally it's the purchase of the Billy Chip is a reaction from someone who's homeless, maybe like in the doorway or maybe down the street. But certainly in Bristol and Bath as well, you know, someone could be given a Billy Chip anywhere in Bristol and they wouldn't have to walk, you know, they have to walk 300 yards to go and redeem it. There's so many coffee shops in Bristol, and luckily we've sort of got into quite a lot of them. And that's really what we want to do in London. I mean, London's very different. I mean, you know, you've got so many boroughs and they're almost like sort of micro cities in themselves. So we've been doing some work recently with Newham Council, because they have the
Newham's
highest
good.
Well, they have the highest level of homelessness anywhere in the UK.
Wow.
1 in 24 people.
Really?
So that isn't necessarily people sleeping out rough, that's just people who may be sofa surfing or you know, don't have a permanent fixed residence. But 1 in 24 is a statistic in Newham at the moment. It is really something that it works best when you have that density of outlets. I think as well, it's a lot easier to convince outlets to sign up if there's a lot of places in the area doing it, because not that this has ever happened, but I think some business owners think that, oh, if I'm the only person doing it, then I'm going to have this massive like influx of homeless people in my coffee shop that might not be what certain customers want to have their experience like. But it really isn't the case. I mean, on average, we see one billy chip redemption per outlet, about one every 2.5 days.
Got you.
So, you know, no one's overrun with homeless people at all.
And in order for it to work, you want, you know, many outlets to kind of respond to this and essentially sign up. And if they all sign up or majority of them sign up, then, you know, it's well spread. Quick question, though. So when people do buy this, when does the money they pay go to the charity? Was that what you were saying as well? Or does it go to the business?
So so we give out the billy chips to the outlets for free. We send you out 25 billy chips to start with. Normally that's enough because of the sort of recycling process of the billy chips. So redemptions go back in the till. But we give you them for free. And then once you've sold them, you pay us the whole of the £2, which is a charity donation, comes to the billy chip CIC. We then obviously, you know, take things like running costs out of that you know, staff wages, things like that. And then we then credit that... we then credit that invoice £1. So any outlet that redeems a billy chip gets paid £1 effectively to cover the cost of what they're giving away. So when we set up the billy chip, we were told, we did some workings out, that the most expensive sort of, with all the bells and whistles on, cup of coffee sits around 60 to 70p as a cost price. So with that £1, you have got a little slice of profit in there, but no one's becoming a millionaire by operating a billy chip. It's people who want to do their bit for the community, you know, fulfill their CSR, their corporate social responsibility, and ultimately get paid for doing it. You know, a lot of places we find, you know, and big chains have got policies of give homeless people free coffee, which is fantastic. But, you know, with the billy chip, they get the added benefit of having recognition for that from a business perspective. And they also get paid for what goes out. So, you know, maybe not be as much as an important thing for someone like Greg's or Starbucks, who make millions of pounds. But little independent coffee shops, you know, they are worried about if they have to give away 5 cups of coffee a day, because it's really tough at the moment. So knowing that cost is covered, I think is a real sort of selling point of what we do.
Likewise, and I think it's watertight, man. I think it's really, really, it's just brilliant. It's interesting because on the kind of wider homelessness issue we have in the UK, it is interesting how developed this country is, how rich this country is, and the kind of homelessness level of this country. I think it's quite shocking. I literally don't have the number in my head. You might know. Do you know?
How many homeless people there are?
Well, obviously, you won't know the exact number, but do you know the kind of proportion or?
Yeah, so I've got a feeling it sits around the 260,000 mark.
Yeah.
But you know, you have different types of homelessness. So you have street homelessness, which is people that, you know,
and that's the most visible form of homelessness. That's what people think. Because people go, sometimes I heard people say, and you can correct me on this, because I used to have a friend who used to run a business, well, a charity. It was called Love for the Streets. It was kind of around kind of homelessness prevention and helping homeless people leave. And he was speaking about kind of all the different forms of homelessness. But this idea that people always go, well, I only saw like one or two people. So like, how could it be that number? So what would you say to that person who says, that sounds like a really high number, even though I only see a couple on the street?
Yeah, so homelessness is a very wide blanket term. I mean, you know, some people even go as far to, you know, people who rent houses are technically homeless, they don't own a home. So it really depends on what your own prerogative is and how you take the word. I like to sort of say, you know, people who are rough sleeping as people who you say are visibly homeless, like on the street. But you know, it can really be anyone. You know, it's anyone who's sofa surfing, it's anyone who sort of, you know, has 6 weeks in between houses, you know, and it might not be that those people, although they feel comfortable in what they're doing and they might be staying with some really, you know, close friends, and they don't see it as that, you know, they're sort of contributing to that statistic. They are contributing to that statistic. So yeah, I mean, I think for the purpose of what the billy chip is, it helps to focus on rough sleeping, because that's like really, you know, who we try and help. That's our beneficiary. And yeah, I mean, it is really hard to get a real number of statistics. I mean, just from the councils that I've worked with, those numbers are based on going out in a square mile radius one night of the year, counting how many homeless people there are in that square mile, and then timesing it across the area of the city. So you end up with quite strange figures, although these figures come from massive, massive charities. So of course we're led to believe them, and I'm not saying I don't. But sometimes they are quite hard to get your head around, whether it's that you think it's too low or whether you think it's too high.
Yeah.
The way that they sort of end up with this number at the end does seem to be quite a strange.
Because it's a hard number. I mean, it's a hard number to even find. Mm. Do you think it's possible to end homelessness?
I do think it's possible to end homelessness. I think that it will be a result of a massive, you know, a lot wider structural societal change. I don't think anyone will end homelessness if that's their main goal. I think the goal is to try and spread the division of wealth. I think that's the way to do it, which is a lot. It's a huge, huge issue. It's an international issue. And I think that, you know, you're seeing, especially in capital cities now, homelessness is increasing drastically. Mm. And it's no surprise that, you know, that's happening whilst the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer. You know, you can't have extreme wealth without extreme poverty. It doesn't work. Chelsea and Kensington, for example, is one of the highest boroughs of homelessness in London. It also has the highest amount of millionaires and billionaires for that matter. So, yeah, it is. Homelessness is a result of extreme wealth. And
that's interesting, because what would you say to someone who says that, hold on a minute, you know, what about people who, because this is not my perspective at all, but people do say this, you'd have heard it before, that, oh, you know, homeless people are just people who are not, you know, they're not working hard, or they're they're on drugs, and, you know, and that's why, you know, they're homeless through a series of unfortunate events.
Yeah.
Some maybe they're architects of. That's how they've got there. What would you say, someone who actually works in the kind of that sector, what would you say to that person who may be thinking,
Yeah, I mean, from my perspective, and, you know, I'm quite clear to point out that I have been in this industry for, you know, less than 2 years, so I'm really not an expert. I can sort of speak for my own opinion. But from certainly what I've seen, the common misconceptions people have of homelessness is that they've become homeless through a drug addiction. 9 times out of 10, that is not the case. They've developed a drug addiction from being homeless. Mm. So whether, you know, that's the communities that they're hanging around with, whether it's sort of accessibility of drug dealers, it might even be the most simple thing of the only people that come and speak to them in a day are drug dealers. You know, and that, you know, when you have nothing else in your life and you have no companionship, it's a very different situation to be in than, say, you or I. So yeah, and I would say that you know, if you are sort of watching this and that is your opinion, then really look into the reasons and the main reasons people become homeless, because, you know, number one is a breakup of relationships, especially with women as well. You know, being in abusive relationships, coming out of them, having nowhere to turn, maybe their family don't support them in their choice of leaving that relationship, whatever it is. It is quite uncommon for people to become homeless due to a drug addiction. That isn't normally the case. Mm. And the other point about sort of being lazy or not doing this or that, I think that if you're someone who doesn't own their own home, who has a mortgage, who maybe has a car on finance, things like this,
yeah.
No, you are 3 paychecks away from being homeless. You know, your boss could ring you up tomorrow and say, you know, our company's liquidated, you don't have a job anymore. If you can't find another job, 3 months, you're going to be homeless. And
it's crazy to think about, right?
And
during this cost of living, you know, even people who have a house, you know, because of the kind of the rise in interest rates and folks who are renegotiating their mortgage rates, like, a lot of them are like, I can't afford this anymore. Like, my income is far lower than my expenditure.
Yeah.
And yeah, like 2-3 months, you could be in a place where you actually can't afford all the assets you have.
Yeah. And you're 100% right. And I think that a lot of people, I wouldn't say like they sort of kid themselves. It might be unintentional, but I think people view their lives a lot more secure as they actually might not be. And I think that's, you know, I think widely that's a good thing. I think people should feel comfortable in their lives and doing what they do, and they shouldn't feel worried about what's around the corner. I'm not trying to be all doom and gloom and people should be saving every penny or anything like that. You only have to go and talk to someone who's homeless and talk about what they did, you know, 1 year ago, 2 years ago. And they were like us, you know, they had jobs, they had they had a place to sort of call home, and for whatever reason that has fallen apart. And there is nothing to say that isn't happening to you. There is nothing to say that isn't going to happen to me.
That's right.
And I think that the quicker people understand that and humanize people who are homeless and recognize that the position they are in is not, you know, it isn't because they're, you know, lazy or because they don't want to contribute to society. That isn't the case. You know, obviously there are people out there who, you know, who are just lost and they don't have any, you know, drive. And their main concern is facilitating their drug addiction. But to blanket every homeless person like that, I think is unfair. You know, when you generalize people like that, you often lose the individuality of the support that they get. Because if you just tarnish everyone with the same brush and say, oh, well, you're all drug addicts. What if the person isn't a drug addict?
Yeah, and they're going
through a rehab program, then they just feel completely, you know, out of the loop. A lot of places, especially in the Southwest, so places like Plymouth, a lot of the homelessness there is ex-veterans. So these are people who we've sent to war. You know, our country have conditioned them to be a certain person. We've conditioned them to be self-sufficient, to look after themselves. They come back from war, whether they have PTSD, whether, you know, they don't have relationships, whether they can't afford things on pensions, whatever it is. They're then put out onto the streets, and then the way that they get support is by then having to be a part of society and jump through all of these hoops where we've literally conditioned not to be that person.
Yeah,
we've conditioned to look after themselves. I think that idea of viewing everyone who is homeless the same way is damaging, because when you have, you know, different homeless people from different backgrounds, it takes away that opportunity to try and individualize their care. And that's what I'm sort of conscious about, is I don't want everyone who's homeless to be you know, treated the sort of same, and people just think that they're, you know, they've ended up in this place all in the same ways, because they haven't. And every individual's person's story and problems are different, and that's what you need to get to the root of. Yeah,
no, absolutely. It's so interesting as well, because, you know, before, you know, sitting down with you, I was reading around the subject, trying to kind of understand just the state of given in this country. And maybe I'm pessimistic, but when I was looking at this website I told you about before, that was kind of collecting data on how much, or how much people were given in the UK, how much people donate, I was really quite shocked. And again, it might be because I live in London, but in London I'm just thinking everyone's really kind of like just trying to get through themselves. You know, we all live in the cost of living, we're living through a cost of living crisis. But this website, Philanthropy, spoke about the idea that 62% of people in the UK actually donate or sponsor. And this was like down to data collecting in 2020. And it was interesting because I was thinking, yeah, sure, everyone's giving away £1 at some stage. But then it also said the average donation that people gave, again, as of 2020, was £49. And I don't know, does that sound right to you? I mean, I'm trusting their process. I haven't looked at how detailed it was, but 62% of the British public give away money either through donations or sponsorships?
Yeah, I would say that's right. I mean, you know, if you're at the till and you chuck your one penny change into the pot, you're technically donating to charity.
But so I guess the average is also £49.
Yeah, that is interesting. I would have thought that average would be higher, considering that there's 62% of the country donating. But obviously, you know, that must factor into it, because if you've got a lot of the population donating pennies, and then you've got you know, the 1% that's donating millions, that is going to sort of equal out to sort of around that sort of amount. But yes, stats like that are always sort of really interesting, because I bet there's no one who's like, you know, donating that exact amount every year.
It just evens out, right?
That sliding scale.
It is fascinating though, because it brings me on, you know, to the point you made before, which is why people maybe are skeptical of organizations or don't really give. You know, the page reported that the kind of global philanthropy market, so to speak, is about £180 billion. And my jaw dropped, because I just thought, really?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it makes me really want to kind of check out how they did this research. But it is fascinating to me, because of all these scandals we see, people kind of think they don't need to give or they shouldn't give, that somehow it's going to be sorted out. But of course, if everyone thinks that, then it doesn't get sorted out. No one gives, right? So what would you say to people who are wondering how they can support you, how they can get involved with what you're doing?
Yeah.
Maybe they're individuals and not organizations. You know, what would be the one piece of advice you'd give them? What would that be?
So I'd say, just going back on the stat of philanthropy, I think that it's key to mention that any money that's given out in philanthropy is essentially spare money. So it's money that people have, it's excess wealth that people have earned. You know, hats off to them, well done for earning a load of money. That's, you know, it's not taking anything away from people who are careerists and want to make the most of their lives, you know. And it's fantastic when someone has a drive and it pays off, but I think it's key to remember that term philanthropy, and that money is spare money. So, you know, when we're constantly told, you know, there isn't enough money for this, there isn't enough money for that, there is. It just sits in the bank accounts of people who have so much wealth they don't know what to do. They can't spend it all. Mm. There's also another avenue of philanthropy where, and you know, this is, again, it isn't a bad thing if people are donating money to good causes for whatever reason, great. A lot of it is due to sort of like tax reasons as well. So, you know, whether, you know, I can't talk about how it is because I'm not an economist, but I know for a fact that it's to do with sort of balancing books. And also, you know, people donate money to a certain cause to be able to use that as a gap in the market, to be able to promote their businesses. So, you know, that's a whole other sort of ethical.
Yeah, I mean, you're literally opening other episodes here, because
is it not called greenwashing when people sort of,
when brands kind of align themselves with progressive causes to kind
to try, you know, and
shift the branding and stuff like that.
I remember a campaign my family were involved is a few years ago called Fair Trade is a Worker's Right and Not a Gap in the Market. I think that a lot, you know, the sort of new fair trade now is climate. I think, you know, people having recyclable packaging and stuff, but it all helps. And, you know, what you're going to do, you're going to tell companies not to do that. You know, what is the key? But, you know, you're not going to get to the bottom of that unless you have the conversations, and unless you make it a lot more open and admit, like, you know, for example, philanthropists that donate all of this money have so much excess wealth they can do it. You know, going back to you know, saying about how people can help, if you're a millionaire, let me know. You know, I'll take any check.
I'll also take a check. I think if a millionaire's watching, you know, we would all love to.
Yeah. But, you know, if you're not a millionaire and you're part of the 99.9% of the rest of us, we have a section on our website called Chip In. And people can go on there and sign up as a Billy Chip volunteer. And what that does is it gives you access to literature that you can take into your local coffee shops. And when you sign up as a volunteer, you get an individual unique volunteer code. And if your local coffee shop signs up to Billy Chip using your code, you then get entered into monthly prize draws. So concert tickets, signed merchandise, festival tickets, things like that. We do a monthly prize draw, and that goes away to all of our volunteers who have signed up an outlet.
Love that.
So yeah, I mean, you know, it's really for people who sort of see it and think, oh, wouldn't it be great if my coffee shop did that? Or, you know, wouldn't it be brilliant if that, you know, if there was a way that I could help my homeless community? Because, you know, be honest with yourself. You know, if you do have these prejudices, don't hide from that. You know, be honest about it and say, you know what, you know, I'm not comfortable giving cash to this person because I think it might make them ill. But then also look to Billy Chip as a solution to that, because, you know, that's what we're really trying to be. And, you know, you also have that whole other angle with Billy Chip that when you buy one, you're also donating to charity yourself, and that money does go somewhere. And people can see what we fund in Bristol. We fund a charity called Bristol Suicide Prevention, which, you know, needs no explanation. They do incredible work, you know, waiting out on the Clifton Suspension Bridge at 4 a.m, you know, waiting for people to sort of turn up. The work they do is just, you know, it's God's work. It really is.
Yeah.
And then there's also a homeless charity that we support in Bristol heavily called Help Homeless Bristol, that have created a almost like a container village, so shipping containers down in very near the where I used to live in Bedminster. And it's ran by a guy called Jasper, who's just brilliant. You know, he's real sort of, you know, heart of Bristol, everyone knows him sort of thing. So yeah, I mean, not only are you making sure that person that you want to help is getting help, you're also donating to a lot wider sort of, you know, umbrella of other services that, you know, and you know, the beauty of it is when the Billy Chip grows, that pot of money gets a lot bigger, and it means that we can fund other causes that might have been like us 2 years ago, struggling to find funding, maybe a bit different, maybe set up as a CIC but not been registered for 2 years. So we'd really like to be able to build a pot of money that can help charities in the same way that everyone else does, but also be that sort of resource for people trying to start their own journeys, I suppose.
Mate, it's brilliant. It's one of those organizations I hope succeeds. We need it to succeed. No doubt it looks like it will. And yeah, more grease to you and the other members of the team's elbow, as it were.
But yeah, thank you.
We'll definitely be keeping Billy Chip kind of on our radar. And I think we've actually got an article we're working on, you know, kind of detailing what you guys do as well. So yeah, thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Good luck with the future.
Top man. Thank you very much.